Welcome to Alpha Trader. Coming up on the show, Brian Portnoy, founder of Shaping Wealth and the co-editor of the book that's on everyone's wish list this holiday season, How I Invest My Money. But first, Stephen Alpha and Aaron Tass coming to you at the end of what has been an historic month of November for stocks. We're talking here midday Monday. Stocks are down, but the Dow is still on track for its best month since 1987. More importantly, perhaps, the Dow hitting 30,000 this month and the S&P and NASDAQ hitting record highs, as well as the Russell 2000, an incredible performance for the Russell 2000. And Stephen, that to me is, you know, if I step back a little bit, probably the most interesting and important thing that's happened in the last 6+ weeks is the broadening out of the rally. Because all year long, we talked about the concentration in the mega cap stocks, and now the soldiers, as it were, are joining the party or have joined the party.
Yeah. And that's, to me, that's the vaccine. You know, stocks look ahead, markets look ahead. And to me, the kind of the rally and the small caps, the broadening out, as you spoke about, is markets looking ahead, whatever, 3, 6, 12 months from now, and knowing that the world is going to change for the better over that period.
Yeah, absolutely. And that obviously has given a huge boost to the energy sector, which was up over 30% in November. Incredible performance there. Financials, industrials, materials, each of those sectors up more than 13% in the month of November, which has been, as you just referenced, characterized by these Monday morning vaccine announcements. And it's really been a lot of great news. And obviously, you know, the human impact is much more important than the financial impact, but it's been great for the stock market too. But we had this week Moderna with the news that their vaccine had a 94% efficacy in a second round of trials. They're going to ask for, or expected to ask for, emergency use authorization from the FDA, which Pfizer has already done. This is obviously fantastic news for all of us. And, you know, the idea that perhaps we can see the light at the end of this very dark pandemic tunnel that we're still in. I mean, the real world impact today is still really devastating and terrible, but there is hope. And it's based on some tremendous scientific breakthroughs, really. I mean, I think that's something that I'm not a scientist by any stretch of the imagination, but what I understand is both Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines, it's a new way to develop vaccines. They're using genetic materials, and right. You know, some much people much smarter than I are saying that this could be the start of something that really opens up a lot of doors in terms of breakthroughs, not just for COVID-19, but for a lot of other diseases as well. And let's hope that's the case.
Yeah. And we had a guest on previously, I believe it was Morgan Housel, who said how in times of war, we get incredible breakthroughs that benefit society for many decades after that war ends. And if you consider kind of the pandemic, you know, quote, a war, the benefits of what Moderna or BioNTech and Pfizer have developed and others beyond maybe defeating the pandemic might prove even greater achievements in coming years. So pretty cool stuff.
Indeed. And another guest of ours, Chris Irons, quote, the Raven, I remember him saying he thought the vaccine would be here sooner than most people were expecting. We spoke to him midsummer when it was, you know, still very unclear if and when we get one. Now, of course, there's the production and the distribution of literally billions of doses of these vaccines. But the fact that we have at least two, and there's Novavax's vaccine as well, which has had some positive and some not so great news more recently, but the fact that it's more than just one, we've gotten these positive results, 90%+ efficacy for both Pfizer and Moderna is really fantastic news. And yes, to your point, let's hope it's the sign of many more breakthroughs in many other areas. And that would be fantastic. You know, turning back to the markets at hand as we sit here today, the other thing that caught my attention, some deal making, S&P Global acquiring IHS Markit for about $44 billion, which is a lot of money. But, you know, shows you the power of, you know, financial data and how important it is in the markets today. And also, Salesforce is expected to announce their deal for Slack on Tuesday when they report earnings. And to me, I recall the beginning of the year talking a lot about excitement over deal making and how positive that is. It gets the animal spirits going and it takes stock out of the market, right? If it's a supply and demand game, right. They're the same demand for stock, there's less supply. But the flip side of that is that Airbnb and DoorDash, they're starting their road shows this week, targeting mid-December for their IPOs, which should be pretty big. And I wasn't aware of this until I read it this morning. But this year, 2020, a record amount of money has been raised from IPOs, more than $140 billion year-to-date in over 380 IPOs on U.S. exchanges, which exceeds the prior record set, you probably already know this, in 1999. That's according to Dealogic. But you know, I was frankly very surprised to see that statistic, given what an incredible year it's been. Obviously, you know, when the pandemic hit in March, a lot of financial activity, understandably, just shut down, and a lot of deals were pulled. So that's a lot of supply of stock that's come on the market, and yet the stock market at the end, well, with a month to go, has absorbed it all incredibly well. And that's, you know, again, a positive sign if you're a bull.
It may be a positive sign or maybe a sign at the top. I don't know. Like you said, 1999 was the last time we had like an IPO year like that. And I know our old friend Mark Dow was out over the weekend tweeting. He kind of re-upped a tweet that he posted late in 2019. And a theme of his has been that people are constantly shocked by the kind of the lack or one of the big bull case for him is the lack of supply of stock versus demand. And he said people will continue to be shocked by that. But what we're seeing with the IPO boom, and that includes the SPACs as well, is you know, Wall Street will always move to fill that vacuum. If there's a lack of supply, they're going to give us supply.
Right. For sure. And you know, Mark Dow, you know, we need to have him back here sooner than later. Like his other theme that I keep seeing in his tweets is basically that, you know, people are going to be surprised at how long, you know, this quote unquote bubble goes on. Right. I think, you know, a lot of us, certainly the financial media, we're all braced for, well, if it's 1999 all over again, the things are going to break pretty soon. He, you know, if I'm reading him correctly, be his tweets and blog posts, thinks that we've got a long, much longer way to go. As John Markman talked about on the show a couple of weeks ago, you know, we keep talking about the 1990s analogy. He's saying, no, it's more like after the financial crisis in 2008 and 9, where you had another decade, a boom after that. Right. So maybe we're at the start of something as opposed to the end. And that would be, I think that would surprise a lot of people, myself included.
Yeah. You never know. And we had, his name escapes me, he was from Raymond James.
Jeff South
said much the same thing. He said this, you know, based on his analysis and the length of time of bull markets, which he considers having started in early 2009, this thing has several more years to go, and dips should be bought. All three of those guys come at it from different angles, but they're all kind of arriving at the same conclusion.
Yeah, that's a great point. Just point of order, Jeff Sock, formerly Raymond James, now Capital Wealth Planning.
Right.
He was also one of the few guests we've had on who was bullish on energy stocks. And I recall him saying, you know, there's probably going to be some more selling into the end of the year for tax purposes, but that you'd be buying the weakness in energy. Since then, energy's had a tremendous run. Right. He also thought that the markets were saying Trump was going to win the election. So, you know, nobody's perfect. But yes, that's a great point that you had Mark Dow, John Markman, and Jeff Sott from very different perspectives saying, what if we're at the start of something as opposed to the end of something? Obviously, you know, we'll only know that in hindsight, but that would be a fantastic outcome for those of us who are, you know, and I'm maybe not enough, as we'll talk about with Brian Portnoy, but certainly exposed to the stock market and have plenty of investments. And I've gotten more aggressive over this year because I am, generally speaking, a bull as we head into the new year. But we still got a month to go before we get there. And just to put a final touch on it, you know, this week, you know, Jerome Powell and the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, testifying before the Senate Banking Committee. There's also the Beige Book report. And of course, Friday, you get November jobs report. Seems like it's less important because we're no longer before the election, but obviously there's still a lot of people out of work in this country. Long-term unemployment is a huge problem. So there's a lot of, you know, structural issues that the new administration is going to have to deal with, and probably with a, you know, facing Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader, who's going to try to put the brakes on a lot of what they want to do. So that's going to be very interesting to see how that all plays out in the coming year.
I'm glad you brought up energy, because energy, as you said, has been the best performing market. And in case anyone didn't notice, a new president was elected on November 3rd, and everyone was kind of fearful they're going to destroy the the oil exploration market. But since the election, energy has just been on a ridiculous tear. And I always get a big kick out of political campaigns, how, you know, if this guy gets elected or this party gets elected, it's going to destroy this or wreck that. I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan was going to destroy the world and or destroy the economy, or Bill Clinton was going to destroy
Bill Clinton, for sure. Yeah.
Or George Bush, you know, who owned a baseball team, was governor of Texas. He was going to destroy, or Obama was going to come in and socialize everything. And since Biden's been elected, his cabinet picks have been utterly conventional. Janet Yellen, Neera Tanden, they're all old DC hands, and perhaps there are bigger forces in play than personality or of the party or the president.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think you can go back over history and say there aren't that many presidents or political moments that really affect the markets for a long period of time. Short term, for sure. I do think heading into this election, there was a lot of chatter, of course, about a blue wave, and that if, you know, Joe Biden had this huge mandate and the majority in both houses of Congress, there might be higher tax rates for wealthy Americans on capital gains, on corporate taxes, on short-term trading. And so from the market's point of view, you could argue that the election was the best outcome possible because, you know, Biden is going to be boring. Right. You're not going to have to worry about, is the president going to tweet out at my CEO or about my particular company or, you know, start a trade war with China tomorrow without much thought about how it's going to work out. But Biden will be hamstrung. And historically speaking, the market does like divided government. So that's, you know, I agree with your overall point. That's maybe, you know, just subtly what might have been helping the markets these past few weeks. Say like, oh, that election outcome was the best we could have hoped for. And maybe that's me, you know, after the fact, putting a narrative around what the market did. But you can make that, I think, yeah, and, you can make a cogent case there.
And Biden's got a long history, and perhaps he is exactly who he says he is. I remember one point, and I don't know if it was in a debate or a chat he was giving, he's like, hey, man, I'm not a socialist. And
right.
He really isn't. Did he all of a sudden? he's a pretty middle of the road conventional kind of guy, and his cabinet picks so far kind of reflect that.
That is true, and that reminds me of one other guest we had on our last guest, Dan Held. Obviously a huge Bitcoin bull, but he basically was trying to paint Biden as a socialist. I think he's generally anti-government in general, but I thought it was interesting. The day after our podcast went live, Bitcoin had this huge plunge. And then it's come racing right back. And as we were talking earlier Monday, pushing towards 20,000. So, you know, the momentum and the attention that the crypto space and Bitcoin particularly are getting, I think is going to be a very big story, certainly into the end of this year and into next year.
Yeah, it's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch. And it's fun to have this platform to talk about it with you and all our great guests. And we appreciate all of everybody tuning in. And we will have much more to come on this broadcast and more broadcasts to come. Coming up next, Brian Portnoy. He is founder of Shaping Wealth and the co-editor of the new It book on Wall Street, How I Invest My Money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. Steve and I are pleased to welcome to the show Brian Portnoy. He's the founder of Shaping Wealth and the co-editor of the new book, How I Invest My Money, which explores the investment choices of over 20 prominent folks in finance. Brian is also previously the author of The Investor's Paradox and The Geometry of Wealth. Brian, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. So you and your co-editor, Josh Brown, a lot of folks know from the CNBC world, you reached out to, again, 20 plus folks from across finance, money managers, venture capitalists, et cetera, and had them write their own story about how they invest their money. The book is How I Invest My Money. So it's first person accounts. What, if any, common themes did you find, you know, across this spectrum of experts?
Yeah, it's funny. The theme was that there's really not a theme other than the fact that personal finance is more personal than finance. And I know that's a well-worn phrase, but, you know, Josh wrote a blog in mid-2019 called How I Invest My Money. And it got into the details of his portfolio, and much of it is, you know, exactly aligned with how his firm's clients invest. But he has other investments, and also spoke about saving and spending, and So when we went out to 23 others, so there's a total of 25 essays in the book, we just said, hey, read Josh's essay or blog. Here's a blank piece of paper with 1500 words, and you have a 1500 word limit, roughly, and tell us your money story. And it doesn't have to just be about your portfolio. It should be about money life. So saving, spending, investing, borrowing. And what came back to us were 25 quite different stories. We were really pleased with what we saw. And so to your question of what were the themes is that everyone's got their own idiosyncratic lives and everybody is building their portfolios and shaping their saving and spending behavior in line with whatever it is they want to achieve, as well as what their values are.
Right. So I love the idea that personal finance is more personal than finance, but doesn't that run afoul to this idea that, you know, everybody is data driven right now and the quants through the world and we're supposed to be taking our emotions out of finance? So I guess, you know, you're an expert in behavioral finance. Is that possible as human beings?
Well, it's not possible. You know, it's a self-serving reference, but I always like when Howard Marks says that if you want to be a great investor, your first degree should be in psychology, not finance. But no, when it comes to, you know, the trend you're alluding to, quantification, data, evidence, rigor, there's a prior question as to what are you optimizing? Okay, so you're creating, even in quant world, you're solving for something, you're optimizing, you're maximizing, you've got multiple equations going on in the complex portfolio for a complex life. But what is it that you're solving for? So for example, with me, I've got aging parents, I've got three teenage kids, my wife and I have charitable obligations in our community and obligations in terms of things that we really want to support. And when you go down the list of the authors in the book, you can just see that what they're optimizing for is their own choice. And then within that context, I don't think anyone would walk away from any of these chapters and say, boy, what a bunch of, you know, stupid fly by night, you
right,
know,
right.
Decisions. You know, Josh talked about the fact that he has a number of venture capital investments with friends. He hopes that they make money, but what he really wants to do with those investments is support his friends. And, you know, kind of chapter by chapter, we see that sort of optimization. And when you add it all up, nobody's portfolio looks like it's on the efficient frontier. But how could it be? Because not only are we, you know, on a practical level, not running our lives that way, we have multiple goals depending on where you are at in your stage of life.
So Brian, you mentioned, you know, your personal situation, you know, your aging parents and teenagers and charitable obligations or things you want to do personally. So can you synchronize, you know, in a shorter than reading the chapter, like how do you invest your money? You know, what's right. The answer for you?
So every chapter is like four pages. So
so not so tough, right?
So not so tough. Yeah. Actually, one of the nice features of the book is that no chapter is more than five pages. And so you can plow through this book in an evening. They're basically short vignettes. You know, for me, I've got multiple goals. You know, so there's this principle of mental accounting in behavioral finance, which is that, you know, we sort of naturally bucket objectives create multiple buckets. And so, you know, we have a kids' college bucket, we have a retirement bucket, we have a help our parents bucket, we've got a charity bucket. And the idea is not to come up with some meta portfolio to synchronize all of that. It's just literally goals-based investing. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, we've got some, you know, cheap long-term investments, index fund type investments for, you know, 10, 15 plus years down the road that will serve us in retirement because my financial capital and human capital are closely correlated being in the markets. I hold more cash than the models would suggest. And in fact, when you go through the book, Morgan Housel, Christine Benz, myself, many others, people are holding a lot of cash. And there's multiple reasons for that. But, you know, one of them is just sort of peace of mind so that you have flexibility and optionality with that cash. So, you know, I've got long-term investments. I've got a pile of cash that I try to invest in creative ways. So, for example, I invest in a private limited partnership that does odd lot municipal bond investing. And it's got tax equivalent yields between 5 and 6%. So whatever the notional yield works out to be. But, you know, that's cash that I can access on a monthly basis. So it's not sort of near term or at the moment emergency. But, you know, I'm trying to do something intelligent with my cash where I can get sort of super premium returns. And then lastly, you know, I have what I call my lottery ticket investments, meaning, you know, a dozen or more small venture or angel investing opportunities where, you know, I like the business opportunity. Usually the entrepreneur is a friend of mine or somebody that I know and trust. And, you know, like most lottery tickets, I kind of anticipate that they're going to end up worthless, but maybe one or two of them will lead to great success. And if so, that will more than make up for the losers. And all I have in my quote unquote model is that it will be a lot of money. I can't do anything more with that. I can't make any plans on it. But if in fact that windfall comes, I'll be pretty happy.
When you say you're holding kind of more cash than the models might suggest, it kind of reminds me a bit of Seth Klarman or even Warren Buffett, who are often criticized. I don't know how you can criticize those guys, but often criticized for having cash positions that are too high. I kind of get the feeling with those guys that they're holding cash, waiting for the occasional plunge in the markets, and then they can put it to work. But listening to you, it's almost like you're not trying to predict some sort of or wait for a crash in the markets. You're holding it just in case something, just an investment interests you. You want to be able to buy it without having to sell something else. Is that a correct read?
That's fair. I mean, cash is freedom. Cash is optionality. And it serves a lot of purposes. You know, there's just sort of the immediate and near-term stability of having some extra cash, because we all see that life is really unpredictable. And not that I did anything bold or radical in March of this year. But, you know, when the market was plunging, I had money to put to work into a couple small situations. So it's kind of comical that I would be anywhere in the same paragraph as Klarman and Buffett. But, you know, cash as optionality is really important to me. And that was the theme that ran throughout the book. In fact, Morgan Housel, who you guys know and just fabulous writer, he's our leadoff hitter. He's the first chapter of the book. We gave him more room. I think his chapter 6 pages. So it's a little bit more indulgent. A long leash from Morgan. Right. And yeah, he writes at some length and of course with eloquence as to the freedom and optionality that cash gives him and his wife as they plan for their future and their kids' future.
Yeah, I have to be honest, that made me feel better, because I think I have, my wife and I, we have too much cash. And so I guess I feel like I'm in good company reading the folks in these books. But what do you say to the thing that nags at me, and I'm sure a lot of other people, is the opportunity cost of being in that cash that I'm, you know, I haven't been in the markets as aggressively as I quote unquote could have been or should have been the last 10 years when the markets had a phenomenal run. And we're talking now Monday morning, you know, the Dow is down a bit, but it's, you know, just hit its all-time high of 30,000. The S&P hit an all-time high last week, as did the Russell 2000. So, you know, rationally speaking, I could say, you know, I should have been more aggressive in stocks the last 10 years. Like, I'm asking you to be my psychologist now, but, you know, how do you make peace with that?
Yeah, I think you're conflating a maximization problem with an optimization problem. Mm-hmm. So, of course, with, you know, your portfolio all else equal, you'd like it to be bigger, not smaller. And, you know, Aaron, like if I ran the back of the envelope on what I could have made by being fully invested over the last 10 years, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it because it would be a lot of money. But at the same time, solving an optimization problem, meaning that I've got different variables that I'm trying to solve for, and most of which are not quantifiable. So we're using quant speak to talk about things that can't be quantified. But, you know, going back 7, 8, 9 years ago, I had volatility in my career, and having some cash meant that I knew that Tracy and the kids were going to be fine for a long time, no matter what. Like, what is the price of that? Like, it's sort of, it's sort of priceless. You know, fast forward to today, things are great, got my new company, but I also now have optionality with that in terms of not, you know, at the moment needing to raise outside capital, being able to bootstrap some of the things that I want to do in this wealth technology platform that I'm building. So yeah, in isolation, we can make ourselves feel terrible as to how much we didn't make. But, and I'm not saying to, you know, sort of post hoc, you know, just justify everything you did. Although I do believe in life generally, you know, we paint the bullseye after the arrow has been shot. And
that's right.
Each of us thinks of us as a, you know, expert archer. But no, seriously, we should be honest with ourselves as to what we're trying to accomplish and solve for across all dimensions. And the one way I've pushed it, and in the book I refer to, you know, in my chapter, my cash strategy, I just call it juicy cash. I did kick myself earlier in the decade for just having it in just plain crappy cash, basically making nothing. And so I did go on a bit of a hunt to find very safe opportunities, a little bit of risk, but not a lot, where I could juice my returns. And, you know, like I mentioned, you know, this odd lot muni strategy, which, look, I could lose easily 10-15% tomorrow if something horrible happened in that market. But at the same time, you know, on a multi-year outlook and treating cash as optionality as distinct from an emergency fund, to be able to make, you know, 5% on my cash on an after-tax basis makes me feel pretty good.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Do you have the ability or to talk about any other kind of interesting or different kind of investments that you make? You've talked about the muni bond strategy. You've talked about some VC-ish type deals, and any other different or interesting strategies?
Yeah. There's a bunch. And in the chapter, I don't really go into too much detail. And some of these are, you know, sort of private partnerships. So I don't want to get myself or anybody else in trouble by going into, you know, really any detail. But we do some real estate investing just from a risk tolerance point of view. And this isn't based on any psychometrics. I know that my loss aversion is off the charts, meaning that like I find losses really, really aggravating, and gains don't really excite me. So the idea of steady income through, for example, rental properties makes me very happy. Pools of capital purchase buildings that lend, I'm sorry, not lend, that rent to government agencies. So there's a whole quite large ecosystem of buildings that government agencies run their offices out of and will, you know, do medium to long-term leases. Mm-hmm. Very, very unlikely that the government is going to renege or default on its rent payments for, you know, these, you know, sorts of properties. And, you know, this is Department of Transportation or OSHA or, you know, those sorts of everyday agencies. You know, the opportunity there, you know, the cohort that, you know, I do some investing with, you know, we're investing in preferred equity. And, you know, we're able to, you know, clip 8-9% coupon. And then on a multi-year outlook, there's, you know, some back end upside if in fact, you know, the building can be sold. You know, things like that. And this was another theme in the book in terms of the value of social network. Ted Seides, who I'm sure you guys know, Howard Lindzen, you know, these are guys with deep and broad networks in the investment business. You know, just staying in touch with people, meeting people to find opportunities that are, you know, relatively small, that you're not going to really be able to see the super big guys, you know, the PIMCOs and BlackRocks of the world put, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars into. And as a result, being a little bit under the radar, you can find some pretty interesting things.
Right. And you mentioned before we started this recording that you're really not too aware of what's happening in the public markets, and you know, stock market on a day-to-day basis. How do you factor that into your overall portfolio, both just equities generally and the idea that you, it sounds like you just don't pay that much attention to it, which I think would be a relief for a lot of us to be able to ignore it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel badly saying this on your program because I don't want to be dismissive of it, but it's just not for me. You know, it's funny. One of the chapters of in the book that I love is from Christine Benz, who you guys might know is the director of personal finance at Morningstar. And funny enough, was my first boss at Morningstar 21 years ago. And now just a great friend. But she's a fabulous observer. She's great. She says right up front, I think on the first page, like she doesn't find investing really that interesting at all, which is kind of bizarre, but also it's true for her. And I wouldn't say I don't find it interesting. I mean, those opportunities I just described, I find them fascinating. I spent 15 years in the hedge fund industry doing due diligence on hedge fund managers, building portfolios of complex investments. So I sort of know that world reasonably well. But one of my big learnings from that pretty long walkabout is that there's more or less not a complexity premium that's available. And so the more you search for people doing super clever things, the more likely it is you're going to spend a lot of time not making a ton of money. And so especially for medium to long-term investments, we've got the plurality of, if I add up everything for the Portnoy portfolio, we've got the plurality of our assets in VT, the ticker for the Vanguard Total Global Stock Market. So for like 5 basis points, I own the entire global stock market. And I don't know, a month could go by without me looking at where the market is. Just because of what I do and activity on Twitter, where I tend to hang out a fair bit, you know, I have the sense that stuff's going up and down. But right. I literally don't look ever. Like, there's nothing to look at. Yeah.
Right. And look, we spend most of our time talking about the US markets, but the global stock market also is at or near an all-time high. I think an all-time high in terms of overall market cap, approaching $100 trillion, I believe I saw was the stat recently. So yeah, that's been a great place to be as well. And you know, the case to be made, the US is overvalued relative to the rest of the world. So you want to be more global anyway. So, but that's not why you're doing it.
I'm doing it on just sort of the very basic, but difficult to follow principle of diversification. You know, I gave over the years, I've given a speech 100 times called diversification means always having to say you're sorry. And it kind of just gets into, you know, sort of the disconnect between the math and the psychology of diversification. Because, you know, Markowitz made up the math in, I think, first in 52 and then another paper in 58. And we were all off to the races. And, you know, he quantified in a very sophisticated way the common sense idea that you don't put all your eggs in one basket. And obviously a lot of interesting stuff on covariance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is, when we hold diversified portfolios, by definition, there's always something that sucks. There's always something that's on a relative basis lagging. And my experience in the wealth management world is that those laggards tend to take up a lion's share of the conversation between client and advisor. Like, hey, you know, the US is up this much over the last decade, but you had me in international stocks. Why didn't you do that? You know, why didn't you move everything from Europe to the US over the last 5 years? And the advisor, in my experience, they get kind of flabbergasted. They're like, well, this is kind of what we do. Like, you know, we're not trying, for the most part, we're not trying to market time. We might fade the portfolio based on, you know, valuations or, you know, certain technical indicators. But, you know, we're going to give you exposure to many markets. And so the advisor has to, you know, end up apologizing for applying, you know, the most basic and arguably effective strategy for having pretty good returns, not the best by definition, but pretty good returns over the long term. So for me, it's just, you know, in today's world of endless ETFs, I went as simple as possible. And
right.
I don't know if it's 3 basis points or 7 basis points or not, whatever it is, it's effectively, I get free exposure to the entire global stock market for the next 10 to 15 years while Tracy and I plan for retirement.
Right. So again, we're talking with Brian Portnoy, founder of Shaping Wealth and co-editor of the new book, How I Invest My Money. Again, congratulations on that book. I did want to ask you a question about one of your prior books, The Geometry of Wealth, which came out in 2018. And you basically said that anyone who wants to grow and remain wealthy should just follow 3 steps. What are those steps?
Let me know.
Yeah. So the starting off point is distinguishing between being rich and being wealthy. And rich is the quest for more. And we know from social psychology and the hedonic treadmill that no matter how fast you sprint in that quest for more, you're not going to get any further. And it can be quite frustrating. And I discuss wealth as the ability to underwrite a meaningful life. And my shorthand for that is funded contentment. And I think when I spend time, you know, most of my career now is in the advice business, or all of my career is in the advice business at this point. And, you know, what most clients are asking is not what's my Sharpe ratio or how can I squeeze out an extra 20 basis points for my cash. What they're asking is, am I going to be okay? Is my family going to be okay? And so, you know, this notion of funded contentment has driven, you know, a lot of work of mine over the last few years. And you know, I say at a high level, there's 3 steps to achieve it. And the mental model, it's really on the cover of the book. You don't even have to spend the $9 on the book. You get it for free. You define your purpose. You set broad priorities, both non-financial and financial. And then you make specific decisions across all of money life, not just investing, but saving, spending, borrowing, and so forth. And that goes around and around, you know, over the course of your lifetime. So, you know, I like to say that what we really need to do in order to achieve true wealth is calibrate purpose with planning. So if you're just on the planning/investing side, you're building an optimal portfolio, you've got your insurance perfectly, you know, teed up in an optimal way, all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, you might be all set in that domain, but not have answered the question, well, what does any of this matter? And on the flip side, you could spend way too much time philosophizing about what's the good life, but absent any introspection on that, you're sort of rudderless. And so what I do through those 3 steps of, you know, purpose, priorities, decisions is try to create a very simple mental model. Now, there's tons of detail and there's nested mental models underneath each of those steps, but a very simple mental model that allows us to calibrate purpose with planning by first thinking about what's really important to you, not day-to-day happiness, but what creates a meaningful life for you, not what others think it should be. And then setting broad priorities in terms of the risks you want to take versus those you want to avoid. And then really getting into the weeds on the decision part. So that's, so Stephen, there you go. You get the secret to true wealth in probably, well, whatever that was, 90 seconds.
Yeah. Fantastic answer. Thank you.
Really great stuff. That's The Geometry of Wealth, Brian's prior book. His new book, co-edited with Josh Brown, is How I Invest My Money. You can find it at fine bookstores and websites everywhere. Brian, thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great conversation, guys. Thank you.
Brian, thanks.